Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Tuesday, July 1st, Joe was joined by Joseph Palamountain, Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for The Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson, and former associate editor for The Times Union, Mike Spain.
So there's a lot going on, and we're going to talk about as much of it as we possibly can stomach and muster. So here we go. Republicans, this is the update. Republicans try to wrangle votes as the Senate debates a policy bill for the third day. Vice President J.D. Vance arrived at the Capitol prepared to cast a tie-breaking vote on the bill, but it was not clear when Republicans would call a final vote. This has been going on now, as I said, stretching into the end of the third day, and they're racing even this morning to lock down the votes to pass this tax and domestic policy bill after an all-night session of voting and negotiating with holdouts left. President Trump's agenda hangs in the balance. Debate on the package stretched into its third day as party leaders press to keep the legislation on track to meet Mr. Trump's deadline of enactment by July 4th. Good thing you didn't talk to Beau.
Right.
All day, Monday and into the early hours of Tuesday morning, Republicans held firm against numerous Democratic efforts to challenge every element of the measure, particularly its cuts to Medicaid and federal nutrition programs, as well as tax cuts for the wealthy. And then, hey, don't forget, then it's got to go to the House. So there is that. Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, the number two Senate Republican, just left the Senate floor about 10 minutes ago, sort of trying to be wooed. They have worked closely over the years and have similar energy issues in their states. But right now, voting is sort of paused, and they're trying to basically, it seems that at this very moment, it's all about trying to get Lisa Murkowski to turn around. So we'll see how that goes. And let's see, is there any other element to this? Well, we'll get to the trade stuff in a few minutes, but we will talk now about this particular bill and where it is and where it could go and what it means. And Jay, would you like to start us off?
Yeah, you know, a good place to start as any is probably Tom Tillis. I was just blown away yesterday when I read, actually heard an excerpt of his speech. I do understand, but I find it hard to reconcile that a person who represents his state could stand up and say, I am not going to harm 600,000 people. You know, he didn't put it that way. He said, what am I going to say to 600,000 people when they're kicked off Medicaid because Donald Trump lied, didn't tell them the truth, broke his word, however, whatever language he put it in. It is an extraordinary thing that when you stand on principle for the people in your state, you're not even going against the people in your state. You're standing on principle to defend them, to make sure that they have health care, and you are no longer a viable candidate, and you know that. You know that you're going to get crushed by somebody in an election, whether it's an Elon Musk who doesn't think you're good enough, so you're going to have to be primaried, or Donald Trump because you're not loyal enough. But we're at a bad place. And we have been for several years, for many years, actually, when representatives and senators stand up and say, I'm going to vote against the bill. And by the way, I'm not running for re-election because I'm terrified of being called names. I think, and this is where, I think the last 3 days of drama kind of all come together, that anybody who doesn't have the either the lack of courage or the courage or this kind of combination of fear and courage that Tillis had to motivate him what he did. I think anybody who's staying behind is making that calculation that, well, I don't want to be on Trump's bad side, so I just have to make this just good enough that I can stand it and vote for it. They'll vote for it.
We'll talk a little bit later about just this idea of the exodus. I mean, we have two senators so far that have are looking for the door. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. Sarah.
I hate to make this about individual personalities because I think we do too much of that. Politics has become a sport in the country, and that's why this is entertaining, even as the actual impact of it is going to be pretty devastating for no one in this room, probably, and maybe most of the people who are listening, but by millions and millions of Americans. However, I'm not surprised that Lisa Murkowski is the holdout and the person who's sort of risen as a leader, small L leader in the Republican Party on this. I remember when she had to teach people how to pronounce her name. She came up with a really cool T-shirt when she was getting elected, right? Because she was a write-in.
Yeah.
And it had to be spelled correctly. And no one even knew how to pronounce it. And so she put like a picture. It was like phonetic. And then there was a picture of a cow for Murkowski. And I don't know why that has stuck with me over the years. But she always struck me as somebody who would do whatever it took in order to get to the answer that was right for her constituents, even if it meant some, you know, losing political capital along the way.
I was struck by two or three weeks ago, there was the piece in the New York Times, and they had this very striking visual of her, a video of just sort of almost literally wringing her hands as working through this of a tortured lawmaker trying to do the right thing. And so now it seems that that's the position that she is in. So jury's still out on that. But, Bo.
Joe, yeah, so give me the hook whenever. I've got a lot to say about this this particular bill. First of all, let me just be honest.
You hear British people talking, right. Shut up.
Okay.
But if it's Moira, that voice, she can talk.
Take it away, Mike.
From the BBC.
I was speaking of the BBC, not of our CEO, just for the record. Right. Go ahead.
Bill is not good for America, and there's been a lot of talk about, you know, healthcare cuts and increased taxes on the rich and so on. I want to talk, first of all, about the way in which the bill is not good for America and America first. This is the irony in the Trump administration with some of the other pieces to it. So taxing endowments on colleges will have a deep effect on financial aid for students. So regardless of whether you're Harvard or a lesser elite school, you're going to feel the impact when it comes to inviting students to join your community. The limit on income-driven student loan forgiveness program is going to have an effect on jobs and on college educations. America is the second leading producer and consumer of renewable energy behind China, ahead of Brazil. We are going to lose that position. What happened to America first, trying to get to be the first and the best, like the Trump administration says? Customs and border protection, billions and billions of dollars going for that. If this is the Trump administration, if the Trump administration is doing so well now compared to the Biden administration, why do we need this huge amount of money going to that as opposed to perhaps some of the other pieces? I could keep going on about the bill itself, but in my remaining time, let me have a 10,000-foot perspective here, because I think there's a bigger political issue with regard to this particular bill, and I'll call it political gimmickry, right? There's been a lot of talk in the media about the fact that the Republicans are doing some gimmicks in order to pass this legislation, not the least of which is the centerpiece of the legislation is the extension of the 2017 tax credits.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is they are ignoring congressional rules by, quote unquote, extending that when it is about to retire. So that that the current, quote, policy baseline that the Republicans are going after is problematic. And it's part of a longstanding what I would call political shell game. So reconciliation itself is a shell game, right? These are rules that have been changed over time in order to avoid filibuster. I'd say the nuclear option on federal court appointments, where we go from avoiding the filibuster down to just 50 plus one, and started with Harry Reid and Obama in 2013, and it became a Supreme Court, that nuclear option in 2017, that's gimmickry. I'd say executive orders are gimmickry. Joe, this is interesting data. Executive orders, as we know, are up in the last 25 years. The Trump one administration is the only administration that increased the number of executive orders over the four-year term. Most presidents do their executive orders early on, and then they decrease over time. Trump one increased over time the use of executive orders as a way of sidestepping congressional legislation. Then I'd say the final one that I'll throw out on the table is the shadow docket. So these gimmicks, these changes, these rule changes and so on, the way in which we're sidestepping traditional, conventional policymaking is problematic. And the reality is, as we think about Trump and his disruption and raising of conventions and the traditions that for 200 plus years the presidency abided by, Trump has sort of thrown them out. We have to look at the other branches of government that are also throwing out the conventions and the traditions of the past in order to do their work. And I think it's shameful. It's shameful across the board in all the branches.
We have been talking about the third day of deliberations as this tax bill looks to move forward. So we have heard from three of our panel members. That leaves Mike Spain. And Mike, what do you think?
Well, I appreciate the 10,000-foot observation, Bo. I think it was really enlightening, and you bring a lot to it. I wanted to go back down at 500 feet again and just watch the votes. I am dovetailing off Jay's comments about Senator Tillis from North Carolina and how just the situation of not being able to run for reelection after you demonstrate some courage and vote your conscience and what it costs you anymore is pretty sad. Everybody's looking at Murkowski. I saw an item where she was in the Senate Majority Leader John Thune's office at 4 a.m. I mean, you know, what kinds of deals are being brokered? And that, you know, and that's just what's going on right now. All these little deals are going on. And who has the... You know, who has the guts, like Tillis now does, to say, I'm going to speak up for my constituents. I'm going to risk my political future. And there's so many senators and so many members of the House of Representatives who are just rationalizing these little compromises that add up to a devastating budget bill. They have no backbone. And they've been rationalizing it, and they're silent on it. There's only a handful of people who are even willing to mildly criticize some things and only doing that to broker some special deal for their home constituents that will, you know, keep them in office, essentially. And it's just painful to watch, you know. And Murkowski, I can't imagine how she'll vote for this thing. And Susan Collins of Maine, being another vote, you know, she at least is trying to get a bill through that would remove from this bigger, better, beautiful, whatever it's called, the continuation of the 2017 tax cuts, because without them, you can't finance any of these other efforts. And yeah, that's not going to go anywhere in this Senate. And then it would go back to the House, and that would never go anywhere. You just have to wonder. And then, you know, what about, you know, we forget that on the other side of the Republican caucus, you have, you know, people like Rick Scott in Florida, or Ron Johnson, you know, Wisconsin, right. Sorry. And I mean, these people are against it for a whole other reason. They want to institute massive restructuring of Medicaid reimbursements to the states that will cut how much money each state gets. And, you know, in the end, what's going to happen is more division, more separation of the way lives are in states. Some states will step up and fill in the blanks a little bit and protect the people who've been cut a little bit. And other states will just accept it as it is. And the devastating inequality of people across the country will only increase, while wealthy people who are well off, who don't need it a bit, are getting a nice big tax cut. It is just appalling.
That was Mike Spain on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, July 1st. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Wednesday, July 2nd, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, professor of history and international relations at Vassar College, Robert Brigham, and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio. For this segment, we had to use a backup recording, and it will sound a little different than usual.
The Senate has passed President Donald Trump's massive tax and immigration bill. This is the big thing we were talking about yesterday. We were wondering, we pondered here on the program with great furrows in our brow as to what way Lisa Murkowski was going to go. And now we have the answers to that. Would it pass? Would it not pass? How would it go? What would the vote be? Would the vice president have to cast the defining vote? And yet, yes, all of that is over now. And, well, that was the easy part, right? So now it goes off to the House of Representatives. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act must pass the House. But House Speaker Mike Johnson and his lieutenants have a bumpy road ahead of them to meet their self-imposed July 4th deadline, which I must say I didn't think it was so much their self-imposed deadline. I thought it was President Trump's deadline. But here we go. So go ahead.
Vote, Russ Vogt, because Russ Vogt wants it to go as he's the head of OMB and sort of the mastermind of the Project 2025. And I think their view advances. You got to go quick because more people learn about what's in it, the more unpopular it'll become. So
you do it right around a holiday weekend.
Put everything in one package, make it really hard to understand, do it at a holiday where people are off traveling, and see if you can get it through before people realize what's in it.
So, the proposal cleared a procedural hurdle in the House Rules Committee early Wednesday, though two GOP members of the panel, Representatives Ralph Norman of South Carolina and Chip Roy of Texas, voted against moving forward. Upset with changes the Senate made to the package, Norman said Tuesday he would vote against the bill in committee unless substantive changes are made. Any change, though, would force the bill back to the Senate, or Congress could convene a conference committee, a group made up of negotiators from both the House
and Senate to hash out remaining differences. If the bill advances unscathed out of the Rules Committee, that panel's determinations about the terms of debate must be approved on the House floor. That will be the legislation's first major test. Fiscal hawks in the past have defeated rules proposals to protest legislation they say adds too much to the national debt. And finally, if the rule is approved, the bill will head for a final approval by the end of the week, which we mentioned is just in 2 days. The process sounds swift. It is not. It can be delayed at numerous junctures by bands of holdouts. There have been several moments in Johnson's speakership when bills appeared to be moving along smoothly, only to be waylaid and subject to frantic renegotiation. Oh, we remember those times. The Senate overhauled the bill by making deeper cuts to Medicaid and allowing energy tax credits to phase out more slowly, among other changes. The Senate parliamentarian, the arbiter of the upper chamber's rules, also stripped out provisions that the House wanted to use to pay for other programs, including provisions that impose penalties on states' social safety net programs if they provide health coverage to some immigrants. Reading from the Washington Post on this, by the way, those changes have made the bill costlier, excluding borrowing costs. The House version would raise the national debt by $2.4 trillion over 10 years, while the Senate bill increases it by $3.3 trillion. The Senate's changes have angered an array of House Republicans, but Johnson can lose only 3 members of his conference if all lawmakers are present and voting to send the bill to the president's desk. So far, Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky has pledged to vote against the bill. Representative Warren Davidson of Ohio voted against the House bill in May due to deficit concerns, but he has not said he is opposed this time around. The Senate was far more punitive than the House when it came to Medicaid. It imposed stricter limits on the funds that states could draw from certain health care tax provisions and shifted costs for the program from federal to state accounts. There is much more to this, but that is a good place to get us started of a setup to this, of where we are on this Wednesday morning as the House gets ready to vote. And we go to Robert Brigham to begin.
I think Teresa's right. I think the devil's in the details here. And I do see these 23 House Republicans balking at much of that's in this proposal. Roy Arrington himself have already said that they don't like the idea that this bill is going to make the debt as big as our economy. And I don't see any way around that. When you can get into all the specifics, but the fact's a fact. This debt immediately will become as big as the economy. I also think there's something out there that we haven't talked about much in relationship to this bill, and that is the sliding dollar. The dollar has slid by 10% since January. That's the steepest slide since 1973. That's going to affect the way that these Congress people think about this debt, because we're not going to be able to get cheap money. Foreign investment will be affected by this. It's going to cost us more to borrow that kind of money. And the United States is not the safe haven for investment it used to be. Just this week, many financial houses are starting to increase their European holdings for their stakeholders. So I think there's an awful lot here that when we do get into the specifics are going to be troubling, and in the aggregate are going to be troubling. And it's hard for me to see this getting done by July 4th.
Robert Pendici.
Oh, hard to add anything to that. That was definitive. But you know, who likes this bill, right? In other words, if you know, coming at this from the right or the center right, massive deficit increase, right? That is unsustainable. I'd not heard the data point before. That is the size of the economy. That is a sobering data point. Let me guess that we're going to start to complain here at this roundtable about the things that are being cut. And I feel like I've said this before on this program, Joe. At some point, we have to make these decisions. We cannot go on like this. So who's going to take the hit here? But it just seems fiscally irresponsible. irresponsible to grow the debt. My goodness, to the size of the economy.
And by 2035, it'll be 135%.
Those of us who have children and grandchildren have to look at this and our blood runs cold.
Teresa Bourgeois.
So some numbers. The debt number, more than $4 trillion. Dramatically increased from the House version of the bill. So the sort of notion that the Republicans are the fiscally responsible ones and the Democrats aren't has not been true by the data point. If you look at the charts, the Democratic administrations typically reduce the deficits and debt, and the Republicans explode it. The last time Trump did this, historic increase in the debt and deficits, and this will be even worse. So $4 trillion. The one thing I will say is a positive thing is that they did raise the debt ceiling, which unfortunately they're going to need to. They raised it $4 trillion. The reason I think that is positive is because there has been a lot of problems with playing politics with raising the debt ceiling, and that not doing that would really crash the economy. So at least that's off the table if this bill passes. It should be done in a separate bill. I agree with Rand Paul on very little, but that I agree with him on. But they didn't. But that is in there, and to get that done is important. But overall, some more data points. 17 million. That is the number of people who are expected to lose their health insurance. It's a combination of not just Medicaid and the Medicare losses that get triggered because of what's in this bill, but also this bill really chips away at the Affordable Care Act. Speaking of chips, the child health program, people will lose their health benefits there. And then many other people will lose their health benefits just because if you have fewer people in the pool, this is too much detail, but the premiums rise. People can't afford the premiums. So there'll be some others who will, according to the data, lose their health insurance. So 17 million. The top 10% of income distribution, the top 10% get about 80% of the total value of this. So those in the top 10% of income receive about 80% of the value of the benefits in this package. It is the largest transfer of wealth from the bottom to the top in history, according to analysis that Yale Budget Lab did.
But is it not also true that the top 10% pays 80% of the taxes?
Oh, long pause.
Yeah, no. They pay a lower percentage of their wages, a far lower percentage
of
their wages.
Sure,
taxes.
Sure. But in terms of their...
But they pay, the line always that the teacher pays higher taxes or the secretary pays a higher percentage of their income in taxes than the wealthy folks.
Yeah, well,
but the 0.1% of the highest earners... Mm-hmm. Get the biggest benefit from the tax breaks in this bill. And the, there was another interesting data point I saw about, reduces disposable income upon the bottom 20% by the same magnitude as it raises disposable income among the top 20%.
Okay. This is your expertise, not mine.
No, this is not my expertise. I tried to get it. What I was trying to understand is there's been a lot of detailed talk on the Medicaid cuts, right? But there hasn't, in my view, been as much attention on some of the other things about what is really in these tax cuts. Because they say, the Republicans say, oh, well, if the Democrats don't vote for this, they're voting for tax increases on the working people. Well, what the Democrats try to do with amendment after amendment is separate out, because all the Trump tax cuts are set to expire. Mm-hmm. Well, the Republicans could have done what the Democrats try to do through amendment is that you extend the tax cuts that would benefit working families, lower income families, but you don't extend those that necessarily benefit those at the highest incomes, right?
My frustration whenever we have this conversation on the roundtable or elsewhere is just an unwillingness to just take on the spending. In other words, every budget argument tends to eventually sound the same. It's, oh, the tax breaks are going to the wealthy. Well, the wealthy pay the most taxes. Oh, the cuts in services are going to the poor. Well, they're the ones who get the most government services. So that's almost axiomatic. We never seem to want to have the conversation about that massive debt bomb.
Well, so yeah.
What are we going to cut?
So Medicaid. There are ways you can do
this. 1 minute warning. Go ahead.
Sorry. The ways you can do it that they've chosen not to. In fact, you saw Letitia James, the AG in New York, had an announcement yesterday where they did just this. Where's the big money in the problems in Medicaid? It is on the provider side. That's where the big money in the waste, fraud, and abuse is, right? And so under the Clinton administration, they had a team that they put together that focused on addressing the fraud on the provider side of Medicaid. And they found a lot of it. And then that was when the Republicans came in, that was disbanded. Just like in the IRS, the Biden administration put together a group of tax folks who had the skills to focus on the highest income earners who are not paying the taxes that are already on the books. And they collected over $1 billion, right? And then publicizing that then generates more.
As we mentioned, the bill that was passed by the Senate yesterday now goes on to the House. And the vote that made the biggest difference yesterday was that of Senator Lisa Murkowski, a Republican of Alaska, who cast the deciding vote for President Trump's sprawling bill to slash taxes and social safety net programs, embracing a measure that she acknowledged would harm Americans after securing carve-outs to protect her constituents from its harshest impacts. I don't know if anyone saw it. She was interviewed on NBC News, and she was just seething. I have never seen I've never seen an interview like that. I've done a lot of interviews, and I've never seen anyone just answer the questions and just seething the entire time. But she said, "Do I like this bill? No." And she said, "But I try to take care of Alaska's interests, but I know that in many parts of the country, there are Americans that are not going to be advantaged by this bill." For weeks, Ms. Murkowski, the moderate fourth-term senator who has criticized Mr. Trump and has long been a swing vote in her party, had expressed concerns about the cuts to Medicaid and SNAP food assistance contained in the bill. It would impose strict new work requirements for both programs and reduce the federal contribution to their costs. But with Mr. Trump demanding quick action and Republicans facing a tight vote margin in the Senate, Ms. Murkowski wielded unique leverage with party leaders to insist on changes. Republicans stuffed the bill with all sorts of goodies designed to win her over, including a provision that would allow certain Alaskan whaling captains to deduct more of their expenses. Thank God the world can spin easier on its axis this morning.
Somewhere Al D'Amato smiles.
That's right. Exactly. So I read that, and I would like that for conversation. I also want to throw in Barbara's letter, a listener who says, "So to appease Murkowski, the Senate settled on giving a two-year exemption to states with the highest rates of either overpaying or underpaying SNAP benefits. In addition to Alaska, this shields 10 other states that also made frequent mistakes from having to pay higher costs. Does this mean New York can systematically underpay for benefits and get more federal funds? Because this is a bizarro world," says Barbara.
Well, this gets to what we were talking about just before the break, which is the right way to cut and not cut, right? Because it's a disincentive to run a well-managed SNAP program. But I want to talk about this whole concern about her agonizing. You know, I'm more worried about the family who is going to agonize over how they're going to pay their electric bill, because those electric bills are going up. They were going to go up anyway, but now when you halt the focus on clean energy, on solar and wind, that was going to add to the elect power to the electric grid, and you disincentivize that, then the electric bills are going to go up further faster. There are going to be agonizing choices for families as food prices go up, because in addition to this bill, there's a lot of other things going on, including the ending of the USAID program, which ended yesterday. $2 billion of that came from, you know, U.S. farmers from the U.S. agriculture sector, right? So if you have the cuts in SNAP programs that benefited farmers, if you have cuts in USAID that benefited farmers, you have the pressure on tariffs that's hurting farmers. This is a real assault on the agriculture community, particularly our family farms. Food prices are likely going to go up, and that's going to affect families who are going to have to make agonizing choices about what to pay. There's going to be agonizing choices around health care and how you get access to health care as the premiums going up. So this is going to cause a whole series of agonizing choices for people. So I'm not quite so worried about Murkowski. I'm worried about the average working families who are now going to have to face some really hard choices.
That was Teresa Bourgeois on the Roundtable Panel on Wednesday, July 2nd. We'll be back with more Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. On Thursday, July 3rd, Joe was joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Tetherless World Professor of Computer, Web, and Cognitive Sciences at RPI, Jim Hendler, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, and Wall Street investment banker Mark Whitman.
The policy bill that has taken up most of the oxygen of this program over the last 2 weeks, as it moved through both the Senate, the Senate, and then the House, the policy bill moves toward final House vote amid GOP resistance. Republicans overcame conservative holdouts to bring President Trump's domestic policy bill to the House floor. A final vote is still needed to approve the legislation. And goodness knows anything could happen. However, if you look at the tea leaves and the fact that most of the bags are packed and put in the back of the SUV that's idling at the Capitol, they're ready to go. And this looks like it's going to pass, but certainly we'll see. The House took its first step early Thursday toward a final vote on this marquee domestic policy bill after Republicans put down a revolt by conservative holdouts that had threatened to sink it. After a day and night of paralysis on the House floor and haggling and uncertainty in the Capitol, Speaker Mike Johnson scored a preliminary victory in his bid to overcome resistance within his party when the House voted to allow the bill to come up for debate. The 219 to 213 vote suggested that he had won the backing of recalcitrant Republicans whose resistance had stalled the measure, though the House still had to take a final vote to approve it. Representative Hakeem Jeffries, a Democrat of New York and the minority leader, was delaying the vote on Thursday morning by using his prerogative as leader to take far more than his allotted 1 minute to speak, assailing the bill as a, quote, disgusting abomination that would hurt Americans. Mr. Jeffries began speaking before 5 a.m. Eastern and has spent much of his time reading testimonials from Americans who said they relied on Medicaid and worried that cuts to the program would upend their lives. Facing tight margins in the House, Mr. Johnson could afford only a handful of defections on the measure. which would slash taxes by a total of $4.5 trillion, increase funding for the military and border security, cut about $1 trillion from Medicaid, and reduce food assistance for the poor. In the end, only Representative Brian Fitzpatrick, a moderate from Pennsylvania, joined Democrats in opposing the move to advance the bill after four other Republicans had initially voted against it, and several others had withheld their votes. Once again, please do not feel that things are okay. Things are status quo, because dysfunction reigned on the House floor into the wee hours of the morning as a handful of Republicans opposed bringing up the measure and more withheld their votes altogether. But that seems to have passed now, and now we look at the actual vote that will come at some point today. Mark Whitman, I want to begin with you.
Thanks, Joe. You know, Joe, as summer started, I wanted to encourage my son to spend a little bit less time on screens and reading, and I was thinking about AI and all of its potential implications that I've been trying to encourage him to read Frankenstein, and it occurred to me literally the parallels here that this B cubed really is. I mean, if you think about it, right? It's a stitched together abomination without a soul, and thus a danger to all of its creators. Unfortunately, amongst its creators are not only Trump and the Republicans, but sadly, the whole of this nation, which in a sense bears responsibility for what's about to happen. It combines parts that were long buried in graveyards, like Reaganite tax cutting, and also, you know, it finds more recent detritus on the floor of autopsy rooms and the Trumpian Steve Bannon populism that provide the temporary gimmicks that they're going to use in this bill. It's lashed together with more fresh detritus from the dissecting rooms, like the giveaways to individual lawmakers, including concessions for whaling captains. I mean, it's really a mess of mismatched limbs crudely sewn together. But like the monster, this thing has no soul, because Trump, it's like Trump. It doesn't grasp the true patriotism in this country as we look at July 4th. Is really based on empathy and a belief in the natural rights of all humans. Instead, you know, this creation and Trump himself really simmer with resentment and a craving for adoration, despite, you know, desperate to be praised and thus incapable, as the monster is in Frankenstein, incapable of love, life, or even a legacy for this country. You know, it spends more on Trump's cruel, xenophobic theatrics around immigration and an antiquated military. Just think about that birthday parade that Trump threw himself. Those tanks are now, or will soon be, as antiquated as the Minutemen in costume in that parade, and we're going to spend more on those types of systems. Not only that, this monster is unstable and dangerous, not just to the economy's long-term health, but also to the moral integrity of our country. It lacks a conscience. You're like the monster in Frankenstein, right? It tries to mimic the language of the poor, but when it reveals itself to them, it terrorizes them. We're going to take food away from children. We're going to take the who need it. We're going to take health care away from those that are most vulnerable. And we're going to gut incentives meant to protect the planet. And in exchange, our future generations get the tax bill that we can't pay, but they will have to. And I mean, it's sad to see, like Mary Shelley's creation, this monster will inevitably spread destruction, first to its creator. I mean, I think clearly the Republicans and Trump will face a lot of backlash in the coming midterms. That's clear. But the real danger is much deeper. I mean, this thing, you know, America's entitlement programs face insolvency by 2032, and this abomination does nothing to resolve that. And more, even more importantly, the markets may soon respond here. Interest rates may rise as markets wonder about the ability of the United States to pay back its debts. The dollar may weaken, and the fiscal fabric of our country, as we've known it, may begin to tear. This thing is soulless, and our nation, and particularly the vulnerable, will pay a dear price for this monster.
I was benevolent and good. Misery made me a fiend. That is some good Mary Shelley writing there, Mark Whitman.
Can we go home now, Joe?
I hope the rest of you have spent as much time writing your book reports.
I thought I was prepared, but here we are. I get up early.
You make such a great point because it's a shell, right? It is this creation. That many people have, and I don't want to say everyone, but when Robert Pendicio was on this program yesterday, and he kept on saying, nobody likes this bill. Nobody likes this bill. Republicans don't like this bill. Democrats don't like this bill. And guess what? This bill will most likely pass and be the law of the land and make a big, beautiful bill, which it's not, but will be sold that and then have to live with the consequences.
No one ever likes a budget bill or a reconciliation bill, and they are all Frankensteins. They are all like amalgamations of hundreds of different policy ideas and initiatives that really don't stitch together particularly well or cleanly. I don't think that's unique to this bill. I think what's unique to this bill is the degree to which people are very, very upset. But not enough people, right? Half of America has no idea this is happening at all, like in any sense. And I think we've been talking, everybody's been talking about Medicaid. Everybody's been talking about SNAP benefits. But we haven't heard as much about the deep cuts to housing choice vouchers, to the community preservation fund, to the legislation that allows Planned Parenthood to be completely defunded and the impact of what that looks like in rural communities where these facilities are just going to be shuttered over the next 6 months because no one will be able to find different funding for those programs.
Well, and let's add to that significant cuts to research and science in America. The university system is going to be
decimated,
torn
really.
Apart. Yeah. I mean, the research universities are already feeling a lot of pain. There's a lot of things that are being held up by judgments that now, with the Supreme Court ruling, are going to have to go back and be reevaluated as to whether there was a class, whether there was enough harm shown, da 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 da. So it's really, you know, we're just sitting here unable to do our work, which was really to build the basic technologies that would eventually solve major problems. Some of my colleagues who are cancer researchers are now job hunting overseas. My British friends, almost every day I get a letter thanking me for Trump's policies because all of the foreign students who used to come here are now going to the UK and Germany, the two schools, you know, the two countries we used to compete with. We're not competitive anymore because those students are scared to death that they won't be allowed to stay. You look at Silicon Valley and look at how many of those countries you had Indian students who stayed in America and created companies and worked with, U.S. citizens or in some cases citizens by birthright and some other things, immigrants. Sergey Brin, who created Google, you know, came from overseas. So, I mean, we're just looking at stuff that has not only this short-term impact of, for example, making it so we have no idea how we're going to pay for my child's medical costs to, you know, we have no idea how we're going to keep the research that could keep them alive with a disability disease that's primarily the research has primarily been funded by the government.
We have heard from most of our group, but I do want to go to Malia.
Well, thanks, Joe. There's many populations will be impacted by this bill. One that I haven't heard talked about quite as much is veterans. And of course, I have a special concern for veterans being one myself and also working really closely with veterans advocacy groups in the Hudson Valley. So I just want to share some information from an organization. It's a nonpartisan analytical group called the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and they've done an analysis of how this bill would impact veterans. What people may not realize is a lot of veterans statistically are more likely to experience food insecurity than other parts of the population. So in 2023, one out of every four veterans lived in a household receiving food assistance from SNAP or health coverage from Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program. So this nonpartisan analysis says that an estimated 680,000 children of working veterans would be left out of the bill's expanded child tax credit. And veterans are generally disproportionately impacted by a lot of these cuts because they rely on more of the social safety net programs. They need more health care, which it makes perfect sense that a veteran would need more health care than your average American. Veterans experience higher levels of homelessness than other parts of the population. So, and veterans are disproportionately represented in the federal government. So if you've been in service in uniform, a lot of times once you retire, many people retire from the service quite young. You know, they enter at 20, 22. After 20 years, they get out. They still have a good professional working life ahead of them, and many of them want to continue to serve in some way. So then they join the government. And so they are disproportionately hit by a lot of the cuts to government jobs as well. So I feel like there's a lot of concern in the veterans community, just sort of bracing for how these cuts are going to impact that community in so many just different devastating ways, just piled on top of each other.
Can I just add two things to what you just said, just personal reflection on this? Mm. But I have done some work in this, and what I'm fascinated by, and fascinated isn't the word, it's sort of repulsed, I think, is probably the better word. But you mentioned of the people of one out of four that will receive assistance. But there are so many people who will not receive assistance because they're not going to. They won't seek it.
Right. That's true.
They won't look at it. And they don't even perhaps know that it is available to them. They're living in veterans' homes with other veterans, and they are looking and saying, "We serve this country, and yet, I'm sorry, what is happening? Where can we go, and where can we move on?" And then you add to that the food insecurity, and you add to that the problems that they have, of course, with healthcare, mm-hmm. and with trying to just figure out where they're going to live, and those problems are only increasing and increasing. And what they're doing in many cases is throwing it into the local organizations, right, like the VFW and other great organizations who don't have the means, don't have the structure, and don't have the experience to help this volume of people who need the help.
And those organizations are very important and have played a really key role for a very long time, but they have also been losing membership really quickly. And it's not because there aren't younger veterans out in the world, but typically younger veterans don't tend to join those organizations. So the VFW and American Legion are the most well-known of these groups. But if you stop by your local American Legion hall or your VFW, you're going to see most people there tend to be older. And it's a great community resource for everyone, they have less and less capacity to fulfill these roles.
But also, much like the food, much like, and Jim touched on this, but much like the food pantries and the systems that are in place, those were supposed to be emergency measures. Those were supposed to be stopgaps. Those were supposed to be if you fall through the cracks. Those programs were not supposed to be the system.
Right. And and just from a macro perspective, I mean, what essentially happens is when you're in the service, like, okay, I've signed up to help Uncle Sam, and all this funding comes in, and you are supported, theoretically speaking, you are supported as a soldier with everything you need to succeed in your mission. And the minute you leave the military, it's like you're discarded.
I just want to note that actually tens of thousands of current military families use SNAP benefits as enlisted families.
That's right.
My parents were both military. We you know, did not have means when I was little, because, and the expectation was, there's like this saying, it's like, if the military wanted you to have a family, they would have issued you one, because you don't make enough to support a family. And so in 2019, the most recent data is like 22,000 military families were using SNAP benefits, and 1.2 million veterans use SNAP benefits now. And even further, I think millions of people use Medicaid in addition to their VA benefits, largely because there aren't VA hospitals nearby. And also medical benefits to the VA are often insufficient for most health issues.
And part of what this bill does is make it harder for veterans to get disability, which is already almost impossible. One of the reasons that, well, at least here in New York, I don't know about in other states, but we're lucky here in New York that many counties, like where I live in Ulster County, there's a well-resourced, well-organized, fully staffed county veteran service or office.
Yes.
They are county employees, and they are, and a lot of what they do is help veterans navigate the insane paperwork to get their benefits.
But there is only so much they can do, because there's only so much that is available to them, which will seem to be lessened by this legislation.
But even just navigate, even with the help of, right. of the staff, yes. it often takes years to get through a disability claim. And part of what's happening now is trying to make it more difficult.
And add understaffing to that. So, you know, I've had days where my kid, my wife, or I have been on hold for the day waiting for somebody to come answer a medical question having to do with Medicaid, Medicare, Medicaid, or, you know, various drugs and which ones can be covered under what plans and things like that. So even just things that are fairly straightforward, IRS is, you know, good luck reaching them. And so the previous administration said, look, you know, we don't have enough people. Instead of wasting their time answering phones, let's create a system that makes it easier for people to file. One of the first things the Trump administration did is they killed that program. So the free tax filing. I mean, it's selfishness. It's, you know, it's
just
keeping
an expectation.
The rich richer.
It's
just unbelievable.
Just pushing so many things onto communities. And communities, I mean, of course, communities want to help the people that are in the community, but don't have the resources, and especially not on such short notice, to sort of absorb the impact of these tremendous, very fast cuts.
And that is just but one example
yeah.
of the so many, the layers to this
yeah.
That... And I think you're right. This is one that has gone, has been completely unreported, but certainly not to the extent, because there's so much else, yeah. overall numbers that look at. Right. Mark.
I don't have a lot more to say, Joe. You could tell. I think you could get my sense of how I feel about this from the analogy that just seems so apt to me. The one thing I will say is if you look at a lot of the theater that's going on, it took me by surprise when I read a recent op-ed. I believe it was by Robert Rubin and Larry Summers, and they talked a lot about what's going on with Trump. One of the more interesting pieces in the article was they said that DOGE probably, by its own claim, is left with about $180 million of asserted savings, far short of what they did. But the two Treasury secretaries said they're cutting the IRS so deeply that they will probably wipe that out.
Oh, yeah.
If not exceed that. So in other words, DOGE was a net loser. I'll think of all, but just think of all. I mean, it's funny, but it's not, it because is, you yeah. think of the death yeah. of people, kids, children in needy countries around this world, and yeah, the loss of soft power. And I think that is one thing that strikes me about the analogy between Frankenstein and Trump in this bill, is that when you're soulless, you lack the perception to understand what soft power is and what it truly does. And you don't value it. And I think sadly that analogy explains so much of what we're seeing in that individual and in his policies and in his movement. And I feel sorry for, you know, many of the vulnerable people who are living in that cottage next to the lean-to where the monster's been for a long time. It learned how to mimic their language, but now when it reveals itself to them, it's going to be very costly for so many of them.
That was Mark Whitman on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, July 3rd. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.